And we're now joined in studio by our next guest. And this is a lady that I knew her family for 40-something years.
Yeah, yeah, I would think
1978.
So.
Yeah. And it was great to catch up with you during the Clare Diamond Festival.
Yes,
when I met
lovely.
You there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you, of course, we have more than that in common, too. You're an old look like myself.
I am indeed, yes, and proudly so.
Yeah. Exactly. Dara, do you know what that means?
Huh?
Do you know what an Ulthuc means?
No.
I will explain to you again. Sorry.
Yes.
Our ancestors came from the north and were...
In the late 1700s, around 1790s,
yeah.
There was the Catholic craft workers in the north around Cavan, Monaghan and that were involved in the linen industry.
Okay.
And there was a bit of a persecution on them and they were forced to leave. So in the area around Watford, there was an ad apparently placed in, I think it's the Freeman's Journal, by Marble Hill, Burkes of Marble Hill, to say that if you came to this area, that you would get land. So a
fertile
lot of the people,
land.
Fertile land. Well, they were promised, yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of people migrated. It's the largest ever internal migration in Ireland.
Wow.
And
wow.
Over 11,000 people migrated from that area and came down. They settled all over Connacht, Mayo, out in Connemara as well. Humanity Dick, if you know the Dick Martin
yes.
story. There was a group of people that went and lived out there. People settled in Tipperary and different places, Sligo in North Galway as well on the way down. But a group of people came to Loch Atorik and Derry Goulin, actually, Christy Kniff, I think if you
That's
know
right.
who I mean.
I know Christy very well.
Yeah,
yeah,
so he
yeah.
would have said that a few years ago that they found a place that might have been an internal refuge or a settlement camp, a refugee camp, if
yeah.
you like,
yeah.
okay.
in Derry Goulin. And
okay.
yeah, so we came there and we came to Loch Atorik. There
yes,
were,
yes.
in the O'Reilly family, there were three brothers that came.
Really?
And
yes.
Yeah, yeah, so.
Well, my grandmother was Hickey.
Yes.
From across the road.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah. So
yeah.
And we're proud of her.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes,
yeah,
indeed,
very proud of her. Yeah.
They were always known as hardworking people, I
yes.
believe. Yeah.
Yes,
and
yeah, very much. Yes.
They had to be. To
and
the, there.
Even there's signs of the linen industry. You'll have to get Christy in here with me someday and we'll thrash it all out because I need to follow it up some other time with them, we promise.
So will you tell us your own personal story now? You've had yeah. big involvement at the charity sector and we lead
yeah.
up to your current job then.
Yeah. So Eilish O'Reilly, I'm not sure did we tell everyone who I was.
I'm very remiss of that.
We got straight. Well, that was.
And your dad was Eamon O'Reilly, and your mum, Gertie Goodwin, was Nancy.
Oh, God, rest them both.
Yes,
he will
yes.
be. His anniversary is on Monday. Four
really,
years. Yeah,
really.
And mum
during
is just,
COVID. Yeah.
And mum is just 2 months now. So
yes,
a bit of a bit of a lonesome weekend
know,
in Loch Atorik with the sunshine this morning.
We'll think
but still,
of them, we'll
yeah,
think of them,
exactly.
I have stories to tell, but we won't do it.
We won't do it here, maybe. But it's how we carry on as well. Is how we maybe. Live our lives some in some ways carries on
sure.
what we get
for
from
sure.
our parents
mm-hmm.
and I owe a lot to my parents so I yeah I was born in Loch Atorik. I live in the house I was born in, which is lovely
really?
For
yes.
me
yeah.
and I went to school in Watford. And then I went working in Galway. I went working in, I was in youth work for a little while. And then I went into the medical device industry working in Boston Scientific. And I worked there for about 14 years. Now, medical device was very good to me. I was a project, I went back to college. I did my project management. I was a quality and regulatory manager. I was, I worked for a couple of small startups after Boston Scientific. But I was increasingly finding it difficult to be satisfied with what I was doing. So I was looking around for maybe a change of work.
A new challenge.
A new challenge. And my daughter was going to college and I said, okay, maybe now I'll restart as well. So around that time, I went on one of those Build It Week trips to Haiti in 2009.
And that
was
after
life-changing.
The earthquake, was it?
Before.
Oh, before the earthquake.
And it was life-changing, yeah. And then the earthquake came right after the January after.
I read an article that you wrote around maybe sometime after that in the Galway Advertiser.
Yeah.
Will you describe when you arrived in Haiti first?
Oh, I was like, even now, I think of it. We came through the Dominican Republic and we were on, I think it was five big buses, 45-seaters or whatever. And we, Dominican Republic was fairly normal. We were on a Caribbean island, Hispaniola, and we were driving along. The roads were fairly good and we were chatting and getting to know. I think there might have been 600 volunteers on that
really?
Trip.
Really? That many?
Yeah, or it was very big. Or maybe not that, but yeah, a big crowd of us anyway.
Yeah.
And, you're getting to know the people you're sitting with on the bus and that. And we crossed the bridge when we got to, we were going to a place called Wanamont, and we crossed the bridge and it was getting on to night time. We were going through customs, that took a while, and night was falling, and we crossed the bridge, and it was like, well, it was like driving into another era. And as you're going along the road, you expect to see the lights of houses in the distance. What you saw were little tin shacks along by the road, and you could see a candle in the doorway, or you could see a little light of a candle or something like that in the area, and just so many people. And this was probably 8 o'clock at night time, or at that kind of time, so it was full dark night, and night falls very fast in the Caribbean, and it was just all to the bus, just gradually it just got silent and people stopped talking, because we were so, nothing would have prepared us for what we saw in the reality of what we saw. And to think that we were leaving Ireland and, you know, our comfortable living conditions, we had flown, you know, all of the modern, I suppose, benefits of the developed, you know, development here in Ireland. And here we were watching and going to be working alongside people who were living in these conditions and who didn't have running water, didn't have electricity. It was just...
You stayed longer than the few days, did you?
I did. Well, it was a bit of a life changer, because I looked at what people were doing there and I said, I actually could do this. But I went back to UL to do my master's in development to see, I'd like to know more about what I was going to get myself into. And I was telling my family and my friends that I was thinking of moving from my job here and doing something like this. And they really wanted me to. But I said, I'm going to take a measured approach to this, because this is a big change. And I went back in 2012 and I got a job working in Haiti, and I lived there for the next 6 years.
Wow.
So it was, and it was...
That was after the hurricane.
So
and the
earthquake came in, the earthquake. So in January, we were there in October 2009 first.
Yeah.
In January 2010 was the earthquake.
And that was a devastating earthquake.
Devastating, yeah. 250,000 people in Port-au-Prince. When we went back, I think it was either the following April or the following October, I think we went back. It was even the change in the country in that time, and parts of the city, like there's parts of the city, if I was to be there today and drive through, that are not repaired since that earthquake. The National Palace, which was this gorgeous building that was a legacy from their colonial past.
French colonial times, I suppose,
yeah,
yes.
But it was a lovely building and an iconic building, and that had fallen.
Yeah.
But it was never rebuilt, which was, it was nearly symbolic, because the Haitians wanted it to be left as it was until it could be rebuilt as a symbol of a country that was, you know, had been devastated but would rise up again and rebuild itself. But it was knocked and never replaced. And it was just, again, maybe sometimes when we, the international community, go to help a country, maybe we should listen a bit more to the people of the country and to what, because this symbol spoke to something deeper than just the economic or the social. It was more to do with their identity and more to do with who they were as a people.
And you mentioned there that you lived there for 6 years or so. Did you and the rest of the volunteers, had you to have protection with you? You couldn't just walk around yourselves?
Well, where I lived on a small island off the south coast of Haiti called Île aux Vaches, which is the island of cows. And yeah, appropriately.
Yeah.
And but I lived there, you know, unaccompanied, and I didn't need protection. It was very safe, and it would still be for me and for lots of people there today, even in spite of what's happening in Haiti.
No, because I have heard of people that they needed protection.
If I was in Port-au-Prince, I would have had a security and a driver. So, which was very bizarre.
And what sort of work did you do there during those 6 years?
So first of all, I worked with an Irish group called Camara, who were installing e-learning labs into schools and into projects, community projects. So teaching people how to use computer technology. And so I worked on that as a project manager. And that was, I would also be training people how to use the computer and how to use the software. And it was really like, I mean, again, this was 2012, 2013. And we would show people how to switch on the computer, and people would be afraid to touch the button because they didn't know what was going to happen.
Yeah, it's a bit like here when we got the electric light first.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And because I was 4 when we got electricity in Loch Atorik, so this was not...
I was a bit older than that when we got electricity. Yeah.
So it wasn't like this was completely out of my known experience. Yes, so I could appreciate that this was a big change.
Big
but
change,
it was also creating a load of independence and access and everything.
Yeah.
And then I went, as I said, I was in Illivash. And when I lived in Illivash, I worked with community groups. One project was getting community-based healthcare for people with a disability. So we had a lot of people who were either born with disability or maybe had a stroke or had some kind of episode. So we would organise for physiotherapists and occupational therapists to come and do clinics on the island once a month.
What is the population of the island?
Between 12,000 usually, but at Easter 14 or summer Easter, everyone would come home. All the school children would go to the mainland to go to secondary school and they'd come home at Easter and school.
And were they getting an education?
Yes, absolutely. But the education is through French primarily, and the spoken language is Creole. My mem parle Creole net. I speak Creole
really
fluently. Well, maybe not 100% now, but I used
enough to get by.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I had to do my work in Creole.
So
I had to learn it. And then I worked with farming groups and I worked with women's groups. We had a lovely project called Chasse la vie, which means seeking life. It sounds, anyone who speaks French will recognise the tone of the languages. So seeking life or fulfilling your potential. So I worked on this great project with women who had left school early or maybe never got a chance to go to school, and to get them back into training to get their a small business started, but also to get involved in their community, get involved in community projects.
I believe you would have maybe known and done some work with the Scarf Man that was out there around the same time.
Oh, with Eugene.
Yeah,
we met him.
Archbishop Eugene,
he is
Papal Nuncio in Haiti for 6 years.
And it was great. And it was lovely to meet another, there was Irish people and there still is Irish people in Haiti. And that network was a lovely, lovely way to touch base with people from home, and you'd get your supplies out if you needed, but you would meet up and talk to them. Yeah.
So actually, I haven't said it to Dara, but Jennifer McConnell, whom you've worked with a good bit here, was in Haiti for years as well the Digicel Dennis O'Brien's company.
Yeah.
So we must make that contact.
Yes,
link
we should.
For you sometime.
Yeah. And they were really, like, the foundation Digicel were really good to the projects that I worked on.
I think she's listening to the show today as well.
Is she?
Very good.
She is. Yeah,
hello,
she
Jennifer.
Texts us in.
Bonjour,
yeah.
Jennifer.
So, 6 years?
6 years,
could you have stayed?
I could and I couldn't in that there were two things going on. It was, one, I was getting very tired.
It's physically demanding.
Yes, and I'd come home and I'd visit the doctor and they'd say, well, maybe you should take a break. Because nutrition and everything, I was living in very remote areas, a very remote area. Like, I had to take a boat for 45 minutes to go to the mainland to go to the shop. There is no shop on Illivash. So every week I would, I would go and go to the shop and get my supplies or else everything else I bought locally in the market on a Tuesday or a Thursday. And there was lots of staples that I wouldn't have had. I wouldn't have eaten a lot of meat, things like that. But, you have to look after your nutrition and things like that. And the heat and the mosquitoes and the different things they can pick up. So,
or the Muzzies have discovered Haiti as well, have they?
They have, for sure. The midges from Loch Atory made it all the way to Illivash.
Yeah, we were in France last September for a few weeks and we were doing fine, but we were staying in one particular place and, of course, we were a bit careless.
Yes.
We thought there's no Muzzies around, but they discovered us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you'll know all about it very quickly.
Like a crocodile after them.
Yeah.
Anyway, digress.
Do you think the country is changing for the better now, Haiti?
You see, we had been doing great and Illivash had been doing, in the work, and that was the other reason that the nature of development is that you work yourself out of a job, or at least that's what it should be. But because you love a place, of course, you want to stay. So you have to talk yourself, you have to be honest with yourself and talk to yourself and say, there were two women that I was working with, really, I'm in touch with them still, they're great friends still. And they would have been able to run the project. We got it so far and they would have been able to take it forward. So even remote working as we know now, from here, supporting them if they need it. So it was time to let go. But then everything had been going great. And then 2016, we had Hurricane Matthew in October 2016.
Mm. Were you there for that?
I, I got a text from somebody in Boston saying, you know, the worst place to be this evening is on a south-facing hill on the island of Villefache in southern Haiti, he said, because the hurricane just turned. He thought I was in Port-au-Prince.
Yeah.
I was in a little house on a south-facing hill in Villefache. It was the most... It was the most scared I had been, and I had had a few encounters in Haiti that would have been a bit challenging, but this was the most scared I had been, especially at about 4 o'clock in the morning. There was a metal door, the bedroom door, say, would have a metal door, the side door, and there was a big bang on the door, and I said, God, is that the wind or is that something? And it was my neighbour, who was the landlord for the house we were renting, and the roof had blown off his house. Jeez. The roof, now, not the tin, the timbers and everything had lifted all in one and just flown out over the hill.
Wow.
And they were sitting there in the dark in the wind and the hurricane. And if, like a hurricane, the noise of a hurricane is like something else.
And weather events at that side of the world are way more intense than what we see here in this country.
Even thunder and lightning is, this was just, I mean, I had been, in all my time living there, I'd never been there for a hurricane. I'd always been out of country when a hurricane had struck, just by chance. And then this was a Category 4, one of the biggest they'd ever had, and one of the biggest in 50-something years in that area. Okay. And so he had to evacuate all his family, the children, his wife, everyone, and his mother-in-law had to stay behind in the house with no roof on, in the dark, waiting for him to come back and get her, because she wasn't mobile enough to move on her own. And it was like, I just thought, when that woman came in and I looked at her and I thought, like, there is bravery and there is, but she must have looked herself, her soul in directly in its face during that half an hour while she sat in that house. And it was just, So we had been making progress we had been making great progress, but Haiti is not making progress now because of...
And is that down to the government, really?
Yeah, the political situation has completely collapsed in Haiti.
In recent times.
President Moïse Jovenel was assassinated in
2021,
I want to say. And so the first time since JFK that a president in the Americas had been assassinated. And so that left a vacuum. The prime minister was in the process of being changed that weekend, which... technically under the constitution left no prime minister, so the prime minister left and then a prime minister came in, but he wouldn't stay. Obviously he felt that his life was in danger as well, and there was an opposition to his appointment, so they appointed an interim prime minister, and he's currently out of country because he has been exiled by the gangs. So from that moment the gangs took over the capital.
And
they've organised themselves into what they call a G9, which is that they fight against each other over territory, but when they want to shut down the country or when they want to gain control, they work together in a type of loose arrangement where they work and they'll control their areas and nobody can pass.
So what are the gang actually looking for? What do they want? Just territory?
Territory, money, we don't really know. They said at the start, one of them said that, I'm going to be kind of a Robin Hood figure and I'm going to put this money that they've taken from us and put it back into the community, but they haven't done that. So it seems like there are figures behind the people that we see on the news and on the social media, because, for example, there are guns in Haiti that were never there when I lived there and were never there before. Like, the last time I was there was August.
And they didn't make them themselves.
No, these are AK-47s and automatic. Like, you can hear automatic gunfire now all the time in Port-au-Prince. We never heard that before.
Really?
Like, you'd hear rifle or shot, a gunshot, but you'd never hear this rat-a-tat-tat effort. And so not only have they guns, but they have bullets. And they don't make bullets in Haiti either.
No.
So they're coming in and...
From somewhere.
And the DEA say they're coming in from America and from Florida, which is only 20 minutes flight from Haiti, they're coming in through some channels, and that means that somebody's supplying them and somebody's able to pay for them, and where is all that, who's funding and who's facilitating? So that's the bit we don't know.
It's not feeding people
and the money that the gangs, like, there is an article on Sky lately and one of the gang leaders was talking again, the man who says he's for the people. But what they didn't show is that the houses that people are living in, they're not the houses that their own houses. The people who owned those houses were thrown out and gang people were put into the houses to live there. The people are safe inside in his enclave, but they're not free. They're not free to leave. Mm, yeah. They're not free to move.
Yeah.
The children are queuing up for the food. They're not free to do as they wish. Schools aren't functioning. Hospitals aren't functioning. The general hospital in Port-au-Prince has been taken over by the gangs. There's nowhere. I said to Gina Herity, a Mayo woman who lives out there, I said, where are people going for medical care? She said, there isn't anywhere to go.
God,
tough luck if you get in trouble.
Well, actually, the funeral on Isle of Ash today now, one of my good friends is, and that's what happened to him. He went to hospital on a Sunday and he died on a Tuesday.
Really? Yeah.
And and there would have been no doctor and no medication.
Child mortality was quite high because I remember Archbishop Eugene telling me one time, that he used to go out to the parishes maybe to say Mass on a Sunday morning. And he said it was nothing unusual to find 10 to 12 small white coffins in front of the altar on a Sunday morning. Children that had died during the week.
Absolutely, And especially after cholera, it was quite hard.
Yes,
amount of funerals.
Yes.
But look, we're painting a story that seems very like, why would somebody from Loch Torry go and live there for 6 years and love it and want to go back?
You'd
there?
You'd probably do it again in the morning, would you?
Absolutely would. And I would recommend to anybody that, that the world is out there. But the people are amazing. And they're very like us here. They believe in community. They believe in supporting family. They want the best for their children. The parents are working for a future for their children that's better than the one they had.
But unfortunately, of course, there's a barrier to that, isn't there?
Well, yes, but on a local level, like community works very well, and they, they help each other, they support each other, they love their music, they're able to, they like to dance, they're like, there's lots, very traditional, so there's lots of the farming traditions and everything are very reminiscent.
Is it a fertile land?
Oh, yeah.
Given a chance, they could be more than self-sufficient.
They have two growth seasons.
Two crops in season.
Wow,
okay. Wouldn't get that in Ireland, would you?
Not at all. And then to see the big trees, like every now and again you'll see one of the older trees that has been preserved, and it's like, I mean, you're just like, that's been there since how long?
Anyway, we'll move up to date.
There's life after. There is life after Haiti.
But you're not going away from the charity, are you?
No. When you see, this is it. I found this is a very fulfilling role to be in, or a very fulfilling area to work in. But again, you have to self-manage that. Development is about doing something and moving along. And you, much as I love Haiti, and I still do some work with people there, let them empower them to do it themselves. Yeah. So I came home and worked for a while with Uganda, with Cambodia, but remote working.
Yes.
And now I work with Boher.
You're now the interim CEO of Boher.
I am indeed, yes.
A charity based in Limerick.
Last December, yes.
So would you just tell us a little bit about the work of Boher and the model that they use?
So I think a lot of people might remember that Boher was set up to send animals or livestock abroad.
Pregnant heifers.
Yes,
dairy
or
heifers,
goats or pigs and they might send them to countries like Rwanda or
Uganda,
Tanzania, I think Zambia as well we worked in at the time. And so that was the model. And we still do a little bit of that work, but we only now ship to Kosovo because the conditions and the animal husbandry and even the cost of sending animals abroad, it's prohibitive. And especially after COVID, everyone remembers the whole shipment issues during the COVID period. But Kosovo, because we go by ferry and then overland to Kosovo, is still achievable. But again, that was started in 1991. And here we are in 2024. And the people in Rwanda and Tanzania don't need the same thing that they needed
then,
that's something we need to move on with as well.
Yeah.
So now we still work with Rwanda, Tanzania, Malawi, Kosovo, and we recently did a fundraiser for Palestine, for humanitarian aid for Palestine.
Yeah.
And we don't have a team in any of these countries. Our staff are here in Ireland. What we do is we find, or a partner has found us through our work, that we partner with them. We will fund the project and then they will implement locally. And it's a better model because it means that we're listening to the community that we're working with. They are telling us what their need is rather than us saying we have something we could give you. We could give you heifers. And unless they're looking for them, they might be looking for something that would help them perhaps start a small business, or maybe they already have reached in Rwanda. Actually, they did a great thing. So the Boher model includes, when the heifer goes out, it includes the pass it on gift.
Yes.
So the first heifer calf of that heifer is passed on to another family. But the first heifer calf of that heifer's calf is passed on to family. They pass it on, keeps going.
Keeps the chain going.
It didn't stop.
Yeah. I suppose the model is that, you know, the old story, if you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. But teach him to fish.
Yeah.
And you keep him and his family and maybe the community going. So does it mean for, let's say, somebody to receive a dairy heifer?
For example, what they do now is the local government manage it. So if a family lose a cow in Rwanda, in this area where we work, if they lose a cow, say, to the a virus or to one
there's
of the
There's a lot
diseases.
Of native diseases that we know nothing about here in this country.
And they'll go to the local government office, to the mayor's office and to the veterinary section and apply for a replacement. And if they're deemed suitable, they will. The office has a list of all the families that received an animal previously and they go and say, it's your time, it's your turn now to pass it on. And they pass on the gift. And that's so they manage it themselves now. But what it means is you're getting an animal that maybe a native cow might produce 3 or 4 litres of milk, but you're getting an animal that might produce something up to 14 to 30 litres of milk a day. And that is, like, that means now you have milk enough that you're selling to into a creamery cooperative there, or you're using it to create, you know, make cheese or have another byproduct. You know, income for paying for school, income for buying seed, planting your land. It is really life-changing work for somebody.
Yes. Yeah. It's great work. And it's Boer used to cooperate with, was it HPI, Heifer Project
International? Heifer Project International, they have something similar.
That's right.
Again, like, you know, time moves on and the model moves on. And like us, I'm farming at home thanks to Dad. I ended up farming at home and a very, very small farm. But I have a farm plan, and like that in Rwanda, in Tanzania, they have a farm plan, and the farm plan has moved on as their family has grown up and as their needs change. So they're now looking for other activities for us to do with them, which is great because it's a recognition as well that they're taking ownership of their own development. So that's really nice to see.
So our mutual friend Jim Hines prompted with a few questions to ask you.
Thank you.
And what makes Irish Aid distinctive?
In terms of from Ireland,
I
would think it's two things. It's one, that there's a lot of generosity in Ireland still. And even though we can be cynical about things that go wrong, as in our own case, that people still can see past it into the goodness and things. But we also have a very good attitude or way of interacting with people when we go abroad in general. And that would be, and I've travelled in a number of countries, and that would be reflected everywhere, that the reputation of the Irish people, whether it's through the agencies and the NGOs or through the UN, is that we have a way of interacting with people that we work with locally that really is very respectful and really engenders this partnership idea. And that's what makes us very different to other
I think a lot to do with that is our past as well. I mean, Ireland has had many troubled periods over many, many centuries ago. So it probably a lot to do with that too.
Yeah, well, they say that trauma is in your DNA.
Yeah.
So like you keep it with you. But
we
seem to have that empathy towards and understanding towards people. But we kind of move very quickly to a level playing field and an area of respect, which communities really respond to when you're working with them.
What would you say to people who feel overwhelmed by the crisis this year around the world?
I would say, one, if you're overwhelmed, reduce the amount of content you're watching. And like, say, I would watch, you know, 6 o'clock news, 9 o'clock news, because we were brought up that you sat down and watched, and then you watch prime time, and then you watch like that. Anyway,
a lot of bleak stories.
Well, you see, it can be, but then there's two parts again. There's two sides, as my dad would have said, a mouse has two holes. The you know, you look at one thing and you can see that it's overwhelming and that what can we do? But look into the story. Look into the story and look at the people. Look past what the bad has been done and look at the good people that are helping. Look at the people that are doing getting the aid out there, meeting the communities, the doctors, the nurses. We saw it in COVID. So look deeply at what into the story, and you'll see where the good is happening. And focus on that. But also take one thing. So don't like we weren't. That's not our job to, you know, put our arms around the world and change everything. It's not my job either. It's take one thing.
And if you think it is our job, you're in trouble.
Then you're in trouble, yeah. So take one thing and do one thing. And if that's that one thing that you're going to do, and just do that one act, whether it's a kindness to a neighbour or a give to, you know, somebody like poor, or it is a, you know, something you do quietly yourself, you participate in your community, you're in your tidy towns, you're something that you're contributing to the world, that whether you use your social capital or whether you use financial capital, depending on how your own situation is, and take that and focus on that thing.
Eilish, we could spend the whole day
talking.
Oh,
look at we.
And we will
absolutely,
someday.
Absolutely, yeah.
And we'll come back again.
I have stories,
again.
I'll tell you.
I know.
But look, thank
it's
you
been
very
a pleasure
much.
Having you in here
this
morning.
Yeah, it's lovely to meet you.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Wish you all the best in the future, whether you continue as the interim CEO on board. And it's a charity that has went through a little rocky patch.
Absolutely,
but
yeah.
I'm sure, all things now, they'll come out much better and leaner and
that's it.
We should smarter.
Better shape than we've ever been and better focus. You know, maybe we'll do less and do it better, and that'll be good too.
Now, I did ask you during the week there, and you know, what your choice of music, and you gave me a choice of four or five of them, you know, and I would play some of them in the afternoon.
Okay.
I have a music program
thank you
between
very much.
Two and three. But I'm leaning towards one that you had, you said was one of favourites when you were in the Caribbean.
Oh, Enya.
Enya.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
So we'll
play
that especially for
you.
Yeah,
that's lovely. Yeah,
and just congratulations. I'm in awe of the work you've done. You know?
Fantastic.
You know? And wish you all the best in the
thank
future. You know?
Thank you. Yeah. No, it's good. Like, I think anybody can, you know, anybody can do what I feel. I don't feel it's unusual. I feel anyone can do what I do.
Ah, but you did it, you know, and are doing it. Yeah.
Yes, are doing it. Yeah.
So
thanks a million, Eilish.
Over to Enya.
Thank you.